Off this morning, and I wanted to start with a quote from Sister Gyanamata. This is in a letter that she wrote to Master, and it points to why challenges are so important for us on the spiritual path. We've been talking a lot about solutions, but challenges are important. And she says, "If we never had anything painful or alarming to face, if it were just joy in God all the time, what would we be? Spiritual cream puffs," which I love because it's kind of funny, but it's also kind of true. I found in my own experience that all of the strength, all of the growth, all of the depth that I've gained has come through those moments of challenge, of difficulty. And why is that? Because it offers us the opportunity to change our consciousness, which is what we've been talking about this week. And there are lots of tools and techniques that we have that we can practice, many qualities that we can develop to help us to change our consciousness. But when I was thinking about what it is that has helped me in those moments of difficulty, it's something very simple, something that all of us can practice, no matter where we are on the spiritual path, no matter what challenge is facing us, and that's to deepen our relationship with the Guru. To call to him, and especially to ask for his help, to ask for his guidance. And it's not about getting answers. As Davey mentioned so beautifully, it's the process that changes us. And that's been my own experience as well. It's the process of asking for help, of asking for that guidance, that reminds me of that part of myself that wants to change, right? That reminds me that I can change, even if I don't yet know how, even if I maybe don't think that I can, just by asking for help, by calling on God and Guru, it puts me in that other space of consciousness where it's possible to change. Yogananda wrote a beautiful letter that many of us have read. It's so inspiring, to one of his devotees. And one line in particular stood out to me, in which he said, "Overcome all by constant inward calling on God." Overcome all by constant inward calling on God. And our friend Jitendra spoke so beautifully about how much God loves our mental whispers, to talk to him, to think of him, to call on him, to ask for his help always. And we maybe overlook this, asking for help, because we think, well, God knows what we need and God's helping us. Of course that's true, he's always here. But it's not for him that we ask, it's for ourselves, because it changes our consciousness. It puts us in tune. It opens us in receptivity to receive that grace, to receive that help. And I wanted to share one thing that I have tried in practicing this, in talking to God and asking for his help, and it's writing letters to Guruji, writing letters to Divine Mother. It's something so simple and so sweet to just share with Divine Mother, to share with Guruji all of my thoughts, all of my prayers, all of my feelings, all of my challenges, everything, and to just invite him in and to really develop that connection. It's so sweet to feel that connection that I'm writing to him and that he's right there with me through all of it. And of course he knows already, but it offers me the opportunity to introspect, which is so important when we're trying to change our consciousness, to really see what it is that needs to change, and most importantly, to invite the guru into that, to invite his help in that. And it's not about the answers. They come, oftentimes not in the ways that we expect, but again, it's more about our consciousness when we're asking. There's a beautiful story of Yogananda when he was a boy. He loved to talk to God. He loved to share his thoughts with God, everything that he did with God. And so he decided one day when he was a little boy to write a letter to God. And so he sat down and in Bengali, he wrote this letter to God and he addressed it, "God in heaven." He put it in the post and then he waited a couple of days and he started to look and see, look for a reply. And letters were coming in for his mother and his father and his brother Ananta, but no letters for little Mukunda. But he kept looking. Every day he would wait for the postman to come. And, you know, he started to get a little worried. You know, well, certainly God is busy, but he must have had time to reply by now. And then finally he prayed, "Dear God, please, you must reply to my letter. There's so many important things that I said in that letter. You must reply." And weeks went by, but he never stopped longing for that response. And finally, one day he saw a bright light. In that light, in Bengali script, a letter answering everything he had written to God. That answer will come. Maybe not in the way that we expect, but that answer will come. We just have to keep calling to God. And it's in that calling that the change comes so often. That's been my own experience. I remember a story that Nayaswami Devarshi told once about, you know, a challenge that he was facing. And finally he decided to write to Swami and ask for his help. And so he wrote down and wrote an email to Swami and sent it. And he said, immediately everything shifted. He didn't need an answer because he felt that he had offered it to God. He'd given it to God. As I cultivate this connection with God and Guru and this divine friendship, I realize more and more that his response does come. It comes through our divine friendships here. And in that same letter, Yogananda shared with his devotee, "Not only will I invisibly help you, but visibly through many here, all of whom know your inner self and love you very deeply." It just touches my heart because that's been my experience. that Master comes to us through our divine friendships and guides us and helps us and answers all of our prayers, all of our questions. I've been thinking, I think as many of us have, about our dear friend Anandi, who was such a beautiful example of that divine friendship. And as I look back on the times when I went to her to ask for help, she didn't just give me answers or solutions or advice. She always guided me to change my consciousness. She was a beautiful channel for Master in that, giving me Master's guidance, Master's help to help me change my consciousness, to remind me and to see in me that part of me that wanted to change, that part of me that could change. And it's a beautiful gift that we all can give to each other, and that we all do give to each other in this community, is to see that highest in each other, to see that soul self. Yogananda said that good company is essential on the spiritual path, and it's such a blessing to be here in this community, or the virtual community, to be connected with all of you, because that is what determines whether our energy goes outward to the world or inward toward God. And one time, a disciple asked Yogananda, "Sir, what if I'm alone?" And Yogananda looked deeply into the disciple's eyes and said, "Am I not always with you? Am I not always with you?" And I wanted to end with these lyrics from Swami Kriyananda's song, "I Live Without Fear," because I think they really encapsulate that experience of God's presence always with us, guiding us. That experience of that divine friendship has been a beautiful reminder to me many, many times over the years. And so I also wanted to share how Swami came to write this song, because I think that's especially sweet for all of us to remember as well, which is that someone had come to him, an Ananda resident at the time, who was leaving the community, and he spent hours telling Swami all the things he had done wrong, all the reasons that everything he'd done was a waste of effort, that was meaningless, that he'd done nothing to help his guru. And Swami just listened and didn't defend himself. And then he thanked him, and the man left. Swami wrote down, sat and wrote this song. And I think all of us, on some level, can relate to that voice of discouragement, of criticism, of doubt that comes. And so I just invite you to listen to these words and listen to this song and really feel the presence of that divine friend reassuring us and guiding us always. Though green summer fade and winter draw near, my Lord, in your presence, I live without fear. Through tempests, through snows, through turbulent tide, the touch of your hand is my strength and my guide. I ask for no riches that death can destroy. I crave only thee, your love and your joy. I ask for no riches that death can destroy. I crave only thee, your love and your joy. The dancers will pass, singing must end. I welcome the darkness with you for my friend. Nothing else matters. God and Guru are there as our divine friend. Call to them. Talk to them. Ask for their help in every circumstance.
Thank you, Erin. That was beautiful. Good morning, everyone. Here in the temple, and also a special hello to all of our friends joining us through the magic of the internet. I also wanted to offer a special hello of sorts and acknowledgement, as Erin paid homage also to Nyaswami Anandi. She was a real divine friend and mentor and guide to me, and I know she was to so many of us over the years. And I've been thinking of her, especially lately, of course, but during a renewal week when she would often play a major role, largely behind the scenes with events like this, although she could certainly stand among the best and brightest, and she often did, of our teachers at Ananda, she had a very big behind the scenes presence all the time. And I thought, now she's more than ever behind the scenes, sharing her love and wisdom and joy with us. So thank you, Anandi. I wanted to share a little bit about my own personal approach, among other things, to working with the challenges of our times and of life. And borrowing a term from Swami Kriyananda in The New Path, utilizing a means of cheerful expectation as a kind of joyful optimism in the face of challenges and trials. Among his countless lines of poetic inspiration, Paramahansa Yogananda said, "To let the undercurrent of happiness and the secret river of joy flow beneath the sands of your thoughts and the rocky soils of all trials." And Swamiji, in his autobiography, The New Path, talks about, as a young man, most of us are familiar with his approach to what he called meeting luck halfway. And he describes these amazing experiences he had of, you know, being the only essay contest submission and kind of winning this ticket to Mexico, this, you know, single trip where he was ended up being hospitalized, and he discharged himself after 2 days using the power of his mind. And again, this tremendous positivity that he experienced even as a young man before coming onto the spiritual path in earnest and diving into these teachings more deeply. And all of us have that potency within us to face life with joy and with optimism. And it was a hallmark of Swami Kriyananda's discipleship and his life for all time. You know, from his separation with Self-Realization Fellowship to starting Ananda and the challenges on and on, you know, destruction of the temple and the community through wildfire, and just his health in so many ways, we know that he kept this cheerful optimism, and it was authentic, and it was real. Later in his life, he was just soaring in bliss, having overcome all of these things through his discipleship. And there's a wonderful YouTube talk where, I think it's one of the Bhagavad Gita commentaries, where he talks about betrayal and persecution, which is another thing he faced in his life. And at that point in his life, again, he just was really soaring above all clouds and in bliss. And with a chuckle, he said, "At this point, you can," he said, "I eat persecution for breakfast. You can sprinkle it on my cereal." So we know he faced life with that good cheer and humor as well. But it's a lesson for all of us to face life with joy and know that God is joy. That's his plan for us, and he wants us to live in joy. And if we look at the world today, there are plenty of challenges. Just pausing to reflect for a moment, from the pandemic, which we know has had many challenges over the last 2 years, to the, you know, the climate and the very serious issues that face the natural state of this planet. These things unify us as well as challenge us. The socio and economic and political realities of the world, you know, we don't have to read the headlines, and probably we shouldn't, to understand that we live in a very fragile and difficult time on this planet. And yet, for me personally, you know, I've had to reflect, in some ways this time hasn't really been all that challenging for me. I mean, it's had its ups and downs for sure. And life does have karma and challenges for all of us. But if I look at my discipleship and this idea of living for God, of living in joy, then, you know, how could I afford anything less than cheerful optimism? Some of you probably saw this cartoon that someone sent me that I think made the rounds on social media, where there's these two little creatures. One of them's like digging in the soil. They're in some kind of black abyss. And the first creature's obviously very anxious and says, "Aren't you terrified of what 2022 is going to bring?" And the other one says, "I think it will bring flowers." And he says, "Why?" And he says, "Because I'm planting flowers." He's got his trowel in his hand. I thought, that's Ananda. You know, we're planting tulips. And we're living in this cheerful optimism. I mean, how could we not? Because, you know, we are disciples of a true great guru. As Aaron was saying, we can call on God and guru, and that joy is our birthright. And there's another aspect to this that I just wanted to touch on, that this isn't necessarily a complicated endeavor. We know that Yogananda said, you know, God is simple, everything else is complex. And I find that in my own life, you know, in my service, in my family life, and, you know, all the ways that we keep busy trying to serve God, to find God through these myriad activities, it gets complicated. And in some ways, that's the only challenge, is just to bring it back to the one simple thing, which is God. And so in that sense, it all boils down to, I only want God, that's all, nothing else. And sure, there are some desires and attachments that I still have to work out, but it doesn't change the fact that all I want is God. In Autobiography of a Yogi, Yogananda talks about somewhere the Greek historians who accounted for Alexander the Great and how they went to India. And Alexander himself had a certain fascination with philosophy and with some of the spiritual saints of the East. But Swamiji also talks about how Alexander the Great had a wise man in his own kingdom, Diogenes, who lived in a tub, famously. And with amusement, Swami told this story how Alexander the Great came to Diogenes and was impressed with his wisdom. He was an eccentric fellow, to say the least, living in a tub. But he said, "Is there anything that I, the great King Alexander, can give to you, Diogenes?" And Diogenes said, "Just stand a little to the side and let the sunlight through, Your Majesty." And so this is simplicity. And I read another account of Diogenes when Alexander, again, had this fascination with him, this discussion and this ongoing questions and dialogue. And he said, with obvious admiration, the king said, "If I were not Alexander the Great, king of the world, I would wish to be Diogenes," you know, trying to flatter him. And Diogenes said, "If I were not Diogenes, I would also wish to be Diogenes." And humorous as it is, and witty as the fellow was, you know, I've been reflecting a lot lately that, you know, this is something that, again, Swamiji touches on a lot in his teachings, in his writings, and expounding of the teachings, that really all of our suffering, you know, which is to say our lack of happiness, our lack of self-realization, it all comes from not accepting things as they are and not living completely in ourselves. And this is really simple. You know, who am I if I'm not myself? What is my life if it's not just what it is, if I can't face it with this optimism and joy? And so we can simplify it, and it doesn't need to be, you know, that we have to take up the sword of joy and hack our way through life, but that we can just live in God's joy. And there's a beautiful simplicity to it. As a father, I have to draw on many sources of inspiration, and looking to the children's media sector, one of my very favorites is Winnie the Pooh. And Pooh Bear said, I was just sharing with my children the other night, that Pooh said, "People say it's impossible to do nothing, but I do nothing every day." And if it's not too much of a stretch to go from the 100-acre wood to the battlefield of Kurukshetra, I thought, and I didn't try this on the kids, but that, you know, Lord Krishna talks about the yogi finding action in inaction, and inaction in action. And it's, again, not some complicated paradox. It's just the simplicity of living in God, in our service, in our deepening meditation. And as Swamiji said, in seeing God in the doer, God as the doer in everything, it all really just boils down to this very simple fact that there's only one thing happening in our lives. And if we can continually bring it back to that point, for me, this has been just a most helpful approach and orientation to the spiritual life. There's one more aspect to this I wanted to touch on, which is that devotion is the greatest means, perhaps, of coming back to this joy and to this God-centered life. We know that, for example, Yogananda says chanting is half the battle. And if we just take one of his cosmic chants, as I've often found, and chant it with our full heart, just 5 minutes, 10 minutes, we can rise above troubles or challenges, whether it's a mood or, you know, some hardship or just a restless mind. The power is there. You know, what we can tap into that practically on demand. And so we have all the tools, and devotion we know is among the greatest, because without it, even the sacred Kriya techniques given to us by our guru don't work. And so we can bring our love for God and our devotion fully into our spiritual life and reap that joy. There's a story from the life of Krishna and the divine consort Radha, his, you know, greatest devotee. When all the gopis, the other devotees, were calling to Krishna and clamoring with their devotion for God to come, Krishna would not respond. And it was only with Radha's one quiet whisper, "Krishna," that he immediately came and responded. And so it's that heart 100% full of devotion that we chant with, and that love for God that we cultivate. In thinking of that story, I realize there's another story where Krishna is holding Radha and she thinks how nice it is, and then he disappears and drops her to the ground. So I thought, of course, there's a balance to this, that we need always put everything in God's hands with that 100%, but not to presume upon God, because he is in charge of our lives. And yet each day, we're the ones that need to get up, energize, do Hong Sa, practice Kriya Yoga, Om technique, you know, serve with joy, have the right attitude, introspect, meditate in the evening, focus on God, and do it all over again. And this is the work of the spiritual life, and I don't think any of us would trade it for anything, because, again, God is joy, joy is God, Sat Chit Anandam is ever-existing, ever-conscious, ever-new bliss. And if we think of that extraordinary piece of literature that is probably totally unparalleled, Yogananda's poem Samadhi, and covering the vast infinite of cosmic consciousness, he talks about colossal container eye of all things made, of burning electron floods and melting in the vast sea of the cosmic bliss, and on and on. How does he end that poem? A tiny bubble of laughter. I have become the sea of mirth itself. And so we can simplify our lives, live for God, live in his joy. I'll just close with Yogananda's words. You can take these in. Simple point of review for certain, but very to the point. The purpose of human life is to find God. That is the only reason for our existence. Job, friends, materials, these things in themselves bring nothing. They can never provide you with true happiness for the simple reason that none of them in itself is complete. Only God encompasses everything. So my friends, let us live in God, and through all of life and through trials, live in his joy.
I'm Deva Leela, for those online that I haven't met yet. So my two previous speakers spoke very quickly, and I was hoping they would talk longer to give me more time. But so here I am. I was joking that I asked Vishnu to do the fire alarm. It's talking in front of people is not easy for me right now, but I'm working on it. So just along the same lines as Gyanamata's quote that Aaron shared with us, Swami said something similar. He said that without tests, we would not know what we were capable of. So the past couple of years have, of course, you know, earlier Jyotish was saying it's not just the pandemic that is the challenge of our times, but the past couple of years have certainly turned up the heat, you know. They've really put the pressure on, and for me, it's been an evolution. How I have found solutions to the challenges of our time has been a bit of an evolution from the beginning, what I needed to do then and what I need to do today. But yet there are two common threads. One is deepening my attunement to God and Guru, and the other has been in striving to love heroically. And these two topics were talked about on Tuesday. They're two sides of the same coin, really. This term, loving heroically, as Devi said, comes from Swami Kriyananda. It was from a dream that he had when it was long before he passed, like he left the body in 2014, so long before that he had this dream of impending world disasters. And he said that what came to him in that dream was that our response, our solution, would be to love heroically. In other words, to keep our heart open, to not contract, to keep our heart open to God and Guru and to each other. And these two sides of the same coin are, in our deepening attunement, our heart naturally expands in that way. And in loving, in this higher octave, not the human level, but the divine level, our attunement deepens. Early in the pandemic, I had a Zoom call with a Kriyapan who was expressing something symbolic of what we were all doing. We were comparing what was and what this new reality was bringing. And she was saying that up until that moment, she attributed her difficulty in meditation in terms of length, consistency, depth, to time. And that it was always a lack of time. There was never enough time. And now that she had all this time, she realized it was never about the lack of time. It was about what she was doing with her time and what she was attuning herself to in those choices. And this, you know, this idea, this concept of attunement is sometimes ambiguous. We sometimes wonder, what does that really mean for us? And it's hinted at in Master's statement when he said, thoughts are universally rooted, not individually rooted. And we can attune ourselves to anything. And of course, as disciples, as devotees, we're aiming to attune our consciousness to the Guru, to his consciousness. And meditation's one of the primary ways that we do that. And that became very, I would say, urgent. You know, it became a way of really trying to tune in to Master through meditation. But we also have all this other time outside of meditation where we're vulnerable. And in fact, we're vulnerable even in our meditation, but outside of it. And this thought of this truth of Masters, that thoughts are universally rooted, not individually rooted, became tangible in the beginning of the pandemic when the primary thought on the planet was fear, anxiety, uncertainty, division. And in that, we had to really lift our energy in order to not buy into that thought form. And it was maybe a month into the pandemic, meditation was strong, service was strong, but somehow I found myself in that stream, having gone into that stream of anxiety. You know, what's happening, what is going to happen, and just the whole thing. And it was very uncomfortable. And I remember thinking, I've got to get out of this. I cannot allow myself to just be in this feeling. And so I took one of Master's books, I opened it up, and it was, I don't remember what the words were exactly, but it was something along the lines of, it does not matter what the outer condition is, it's our response. That is where our control is, and I'm trying to remember that for this talk. Our reaction is where our control is. And in that moment, I felt this clarity that this is where my strategy, this is what I need to do. Like, keep my mind in Master, really. That's what it was. And not just in meditation, not just in my words, but in my thoughts all the time. And I decided, I made a strategy at that point that I would read the books again, that I would read all the books that I had read and read them again that I hadn't read. And this is something that I've been doing for 2 years and still am doing. It's been a really tremendous gift to do that. I mean, the gift is in these books that we've been given, but the teachings are incredible. And the more you read them, the more you receive. It's like that saying that no man enters the same river twice. You know, it's like you don't enter the same book twice. You keep receiving and learning. And but you know, it's the other aspect of this attunement to Master. It has not been a singular relationship. It's not been just me and Master or me and Swamiji. It's also Ananda, our spiritual family, that the strength has come. And I, you know, recently in January, we celebrated Master's birthday, and we all did the vow together. And I, somehow one of the lines stood out to me in a way that it had never before. It was, I will join my energies to those of my Guru Bhais, my spiritual family on earth, and I will work in harmony with the living representatives of this ray of divine masters. Of course, it's a little bit different, but that's the essence. And that broader connection with not just me and Master, but me and my fellow Guru Bhais, the Sangha, the spiritual family. And when I was new to Ananda, I had a real lesson in this. I came here 26 years ago for the first time. I moved here 24 years ago, and I had been living here for 2 years, so like roughly 22 years ago. I was working in the Sangha office at that time, and I was serving, doing treasures along the path, listening to Swami Kriyananda's talks, and just, you know, in that job, in that service or role that I had, listening to Swami's talks was tremendous. It was, of course, the teaching, the words, but it was the vibration of his voice and his consciousness that I was receiving. So I was having a conversation with a disciple who had been on the path longer. And she said, you know, it's about attunement. We were talking about attunement. I was telling her what I was experiencing, because it was really the first time I had that experience of what that felt like to be in tune. I'd heard the word and I'd been told to, you know, this is important, but I felt it in listening to Swami. And I remember having the conversation with this woman, and she said, you know, it's very important to have that personal attunement with Master, with Swamiji, with Ananda, because without it, if you don't cultivate that, and it's a cultivation, you know, it's something that you have to continue. It's not done once. Without cultivating that and having that, there will be something eventually that you won't understand, that you won't like, and it will take you off the path. But if you have that deeper inner attunement, that deep connection with Master, with Swamiji, with Ananda, you may still have that thing that you don't understand, that you don't like, that you don't agree with even. But there'll be this underlying trust and faith in what's happening, in the decisions being made, because you're connecting in this deeper way. You're connecting to the purpose of why we're here in the first place, what Ananda is, who we are, and what's really happening, not the surface event. And this thing about this attunement is that we also have the ability to ask the right questions in the right way with a aim of understanding and an aim toward harmony, which, you know, we don't all agree always on things, but this respect and harmony are essential for our longevity on the path. If we want to stick with it, it's got to be there, because you're undermined by this division that's happening if that harmony isn't there. So we have to find it. We have to always seek it. And if Swami said harmony is attunement is harmony, and I think also calmness is harmony. I mean, attunement. Calmness is also found in attunement, because there's that deeper connection. You know, you're not in the surface storms, you're in the deeper connection with the deep ocean, you know? And in that calmness, in that harmony, is where this heroic love is available. You know, it's not going to automatically happen. Attunement, heroic love, they're disciplines, really, both of them. And I think they work together. This heroic love is not easy, as they were talking about on Tuesday. It's something that we have to work at. We have to rise above our likes and dislikes, above our opinions, to access it. It's heroic because it's not easy. Seva gave us an example in this when she said she had a difficult time feeling love for other people until she learned to love with God's love, and that's heroic love, God's love. It's loving with God's love. It's, you know, it's rising above the human separation of things and connecting with the soul, the soul level. And that, you know, is something we're working, we're all working on. And the wonderful thing about being in community and attuning with each other is that when we forget, because it's definitely not just a linear journey, we keep going along fine, and then something happens in our world that we forget. But then we don't have to look far for the examples around us, and that's been my solution as well. So I look to those who've been doing it longer, I look at those who are more in tune than me, and I am reminded again and again, this is where I'm going, and this is the solution. So I think.
Definitely one of the benefits going last is now my batteries are filled with inspiration, so.
40 minutes.
Yeah, and I have 40 minutes, so you better sit tight. We're in for the long ride here. So, my name is Dion, and I serve with Online with Ananda here in Ananda Village. And today's topic is on faith and how to make our faith dynamic as a tool for overcoming our challenges. And this topic became an interest of mine, naturally, as a result of testing. And I was going through a test some years ago, and I just found it very difficult to reason myself out of the test, as it usually is the case. So I sought the counsel of someone who's been around for a long time, a founding member. And at that time in my life, I thought it was important for me to lay out every detail of the test. So I made sure painstakingly he knew exactly what was going on. But then like a lightning bolt, a thought came and I blurted it out. Do you still doubt? And his response was very surprising, because not only did it help to neutralize sort of the reactions that I was feeling, but it gave me a little insight to the nature between doubt and faith. And his response was, of course I doubt. If I didn't doubt, I would be free. Wow. I guess what Master said, we're not free from delusion until we're in nirvikalpa samadhi. And that just helped me to understand a little bit that as long as I'm experiencing life on this plane of duality, that my experience is placed somewhere on a spectrum between worldly consciousness on one end, spiritual resistance, maybe even spiritual doubt, and on the other end is soul aspiration, communion with a higher reality. And all of us are somewhere along this spectrum. And it doesn't matter so much where we are, of course, it's where we're going. The spiritual path is directional. And it's interesting when we think about what Yogananda said of free will, that it really only extends to a twofold decision. Are we going to accept God's love, or are we going to reject God's love? And maybe something a little more relevant, because it's not like we're living our day, I'm going to reject God's love in this. I'm going to accept God's love. It's a little more subtle than that. But maybe I invite you all to look at your own life. In what areas have you grown maybe a little comfortable, a little complacent, maybe a little bit self-satisfied with your current progress? And what other areas do you find yourself always stoking the fire of devotion, always putting out more energy to meditate deeper, to serve with more energy, and to see how can we inspire ourselves to continue putting out effort, steady effort, every day. As Master said, the minutes are more important than the years. It's not leaps and bounds that we make this progress. It's really in the day-to-day decisions that engage our will, that move us steadily towards our goal. So I want to offer a three-step process for filling our minutes with God's presence. And so the first step is conscious use of our memory. And I know we heard a little bit about that from Nyaswami Devi earlier this week, but I want to pick it up on the topic of faith. Because interestingly enough, these teachings are very practical. And Yogananda said one of the greatest ways to develop faith is to remember. Not only remember the experience, But recall the past experiences where we felt the blessings of God in our lives, that we felt an opening, where joy was experienced, where we felt expansive and one with a deeper reality. And recall that state of consciousness to our present reality, and then infuse our awareness with that living presence of God. Because interestingly enough, one of the signs of a true spiritual experience is that it doesn't diminish over time. It's registered in eternity. It's just as much with us now as it was then. But why are we not remembering it? Because we forget. And I was thinking about this topic of faith, and you know, one of the greatest sort of tools of Maya is discouragement. What causes us to grow discouraged? We forget that we have that unlimited potential within ourselves to rise above any challenge in life. We forget. But if we remember those moments, starting from the moment we first started meditating, the moment that we took discipleship, and many moments in between, when God presented himself to us, and we felt our true nature, even a sliver of that nature. But it's interesting when we think about, or when I think about, why I'm attracted to studying the lives of saints. What is it about it? Yes, of course, they can levitate, and they can materialize, and they can do all these things. But what inspires me, and maybe you feel the same, is looking at the life of a saint, what we see is time and again, Divine Mother making her presence known by appearing to the saint, by healing the saint, by moving through the saint and blessing their disciples. And we're reminded, wow, if they can do it, maybe I can do it. And so it is in our lives that we have sort of chapters of our autobiography. And in those chapters, there are moments when God's presence has been experienced. Remember those experiences and take it as far as Yogananda encouraged, to every time we sit to meditate, recall your deepest meditation. Don't just go in there haphazardly, but to remember the deepest meditation and to recall that consciousness to your present efforts. Because it's a principle of magnetism. How we lead is what we're going to attract. So if we lead with an uplifted state of consciousness, we're going to attract uplifted state of consciousness. And so, Yogananda, being a true master, he showed us this in his autobiography of a yogi. And if there is one chapter that sort of picked up this topic on faith, it must be the two penniless boys in Brindaban. Because here's Master talking with his older brother, and his older brother's, you have to take your life more seriously. You have to earn money, get a profession, be realistic in life. And he said, my faith in God is the most practical. I put you to a challenge, his older brother said. Go into the holy city of Brindavan without a penny to your name, with a one-way ticket, with your lips sealed. You can't tell a soul about your predicament. And you have to provide food for yourself. You have to get a return ticket without telling anybody. And if you do this, I will become your disciple. Wow, stakes are high. Okay, I gotta do this. But did Master flinch? Of course not. He said, absolutely, no problem. Divine Mother's proved herself before. She'll do it again. But for the sake of us, what did he do? He started to reflect all those instances when Divine Mother came to him, whether it was the healing of cholera, his high school diploma, the appearance of his guru, and he started listing them, which I found very interesting. I'm sure he didn't necessarily need to do that, but as Davy said, masters behave in this world as an example for us. And that shows that if we keep our memory alive with those divine experiences, not the details are irrelevant, but the consciousness of those experiences, no test is ever too great. Since the Olympics, I think the Olympics is going on, I believe so. People have been referring to it a lot. I've been seeing a lot of threads on YouTube about it, but anyway, when an Olympic athlete is training to be a gold medalist, do you think they're free from tests? they're constantly being met with, you know, limitations, whether in physical, mental opposition in themselves. And if they lose track of why they're doing what they're doing, discouragement sets in, they'll throw in their towel, and they give up. And so it is for us, who's scaling the mountaintop towards self-realization. It's not a question of, are we going to be tested? Will our faith be tested? Of course it will, but how will we respond to those tests are what going to determine whether we keep scaling that mountaintop. So keeping God fresh in our consciousness, our heart open to that living, breathing reality that is just beyond what the senses tell us. And we can draw that experience back to the forefront of our awareness. So step two. So we have memory. But step two is leading with self-offering as a tool for growth, as a way to develop faith. There's this beautiful cartoon that I saw years ago that I wish I showed Christian or somebody so they can put it on the board, but I'll do my best to describe it. There was this little girl holding a tiny teddy bear. Not just holding the teddy bear, clenching the teddy bear. And Jesus is kneeling before this girl. And behind Jesus' back is a big fluffy teddy bear. You know, as a parent, you're hiding the present for your kids, and it's a big moment. And Jesus says, "Trust in me." And the girl looking down at the teddy bear, clenching, "But I love it, God." It's holding on to the tiny teddy bear. What's your teddy bear? What are you holding on to? What am I holding on to? I'm sure I have a whole bullet cart full of teddy bears that I think that I need in order to be successful, happy, fulfilled. But this attitude of self-offering helps us to recognize that we may not know. Can I have a tissue? Sorry.
Business is good.
It has been a year of tissues and, you know, when we offer ourselves, we don't need to necessarily know what the end result's going to be. As Yoganandaji said, samadhi is beyond expectancy of, beyond the expectations, imagination of expectancy. And so we don't need to necessarily know what we're offering ourselves into, but to be open to God revealing himself to us. And how do we be open? By being self-honest, by doing the work to introspect, by opening our heart in the most sensitive and sometimes most vulnerable ways, because only until we open ourselves to God will he enter and will he reveal himself to us. You know, when we look at our current reality, it's hard to imagine we comprehend more than a pinpoint of what's in store for us. That cosmic sea of ultimate bliss beyond imagination of expectancy. What an incredible promise. But can sometimes seem a little staggering, right? How do we make that practical? How do we make it real for us? We have the tools, but underneath the tools, behind the tools, is that teaching, of self-offering. How can we open ourselves, invite the divine into our lives so that that light can reveal itself to us. When I was thinking about this attitude of self-offering and how it deepens faith, an interesting sort of sequence came to mind, that when we are willing to offer ourselves, it leads to receptivity. It leads to an openness that makes it possible for God to come. It's sort of like holding on a sponge. If we're clenching the sponge, can it absorb water? We have to first let go of the sponge, and then it'll do what it does best, absorb the water. And so it is for our heart, that as long as we're holding on to what we think we need to do, what is necessary for our happiness, the goals we have to succeed before we're fulfilled, the kind of meditations we have before we're finding God, we're holding on to that pinpoint on that teddy bear. And if we can just learn to let go and trust in God, that the divine knows far better than we do what we need, far better than we do on what is going to heal us, But that grace is attracted to us by being vulnerable, by opening ourselves and laying our lives at the feet of the Guru, the feet of the Divine. And so when we're leading with self-offering, it leads to receptivity. And receptivity draws the experience of the Divine in our lives. And from that experience, we have the faith. And so from self-offering, we entrust our lives into God's hands. And from that trust, we find that everything we've ever wanted will be found in that divine experience. And we have tools for this, don't we? I mean, Yoganandaji said that you practice 1/100th of what I came to bring and you'll find God. It will lead you to that divine experience. But more than technique, he brought a way of life. And behind the teachings, the techniques, there's one aim. It's that self-offering. How can we offer all that we are on the altar of omnipresence? But it's interesting, though, when we look at the techniques, because Swamiji said, techniques alone won't give us God, but they give us a way to give ourselves to God. And so go into the techniques with that attitude, self-offering. Go into it knowing that there's a subtle power and intelligence behind the technique, guiding us upward, reclaiming our scattered energy, and focusing it where it belongs in Nukutasta. I had an experience once with the energization exercises that I'd like to relate with you, to you. It was, again, I would say almost borderline spiritual experience, and I often recall this whenever I struggle with my energization. It's like, remember, there's a potential there that you can tap into. And again, I was dealing with a mood, some challenge, some resistance. And again, I tried to reason it away. Okay, I'm going to meditate tonight. And this thought kept coming. No, go outside and energize. But don't just energize like you normally do. Energize with the thought of Master energizing through you. Wow, novelty. I know we've heard it, but it had a power behind it. So I went outside, and with all my might, I energized, and it felt like Master's presence was being drawn into my muscles and intensing with will, and that something was being released as I relaxed and felt. It was extraordinary, because within a few exercises, that mood not only evaporated, it was totally gone, but my state of consciousness was joyous. Like, it just totally transformed my reality. And so the techniques have that potential. We all have that potential if we put that energy into the techniques that Master gave us. But I want to explore a story with you on a different approach to an often heard story. Because we have to always take what we experience in meditation and infuse it into our daily life, into our service, into our relationships, into everything. Make it vibrant with God's presence. And so this is a story about the monastery, a once thriving monastery, now with only 4 little old monks. And they were getting a little concerned that their vocation was going to dry up and going to dissipate. And so the head monk thought to seek wise counsel from a wise person in the village. And he went there and asked him all these questions of how the monastery can be saved. And for some reason, as wise people do, they sort of avoid the questions directly, you know, and they give some other guidance. And as the head monk was taking his leave, the wise men said, "And remember, one of you is the Messiah." "Really? What are you talking about? Like, that's not what I came here for." Like, okay, that's interesting. But as he was walking back, you know, to the monastery, started reflecting, well, I'm not the monastery. I mean, I'm not the Messiah. Maybe Brother Job is the Messiah. Maybe Brother Henry is the Messiah. And he gets back to the monastery and he relates it to the other 3 monks. And it's like, one of us is the Messiah. And they just got everybody thinking. But what happened that was really interesting was the entire dynamic in the monastery changed. Because instead of just approaching personality to personality, ego to ego, they were approaching it with a certain receptivity. God is in this soul. This could be the Messiah. This could be God incarnate coming to me and awakening my consciousness. And it changed the dynamic of their interaction, which changed the magnetism of the monastery, which then started drawing more people. But I want to approach this not so much building an outward monastery, but the inner hermitage of our own discipleship, of our own life in God. Because the more we can see everything we experience in life as the Christ consciousness coming to us, the Messiah is coming to us through the hardships, through the circumstances, through our relationships, both pleasant and unpleasant. Our karma is simply a returning of energy for our benefit, fuel for our devotional self-offering. And so if we can see behind what the senses tell us and develop that divine x-ray vision to see the Christ extending his blessing, inviting us to rise behind everything we experience, then we can make our life rich with constant reminders of how close and how loving, how supportive, how fulfilling, how complete this life in God is. Techniques help us to lift our consciousness, but in that lifting of consciousness, our perspective becomes more open, and we see that God is ever near and ever dear. And if we can offer ourselves in that experience, in every way, every reminder, you know, it's usually in the hardships, I'm sorry to say, that we grow. Yogananda said, challenges spur our growth. But circumstances are also neutral. It's how we respond to the circumstances that give them their relative power. So if we can respond by just asking a simple question, where are you, God? Where are you behind this experience? What lesson do I have to learn here? What do I have to give up here? If we ask those questions, we will receive the answers in our heart. So step three, the last step, which is shorter, which I'll sum up, is we have to say yes to God. We hear it all the time, say yes to life and make it snappy. Right? Because when we talk about offering ourselves, it can be sometimes seemingly abstract, especially when our heart is upset in a challenging moment. Offer ourselves to what? Into this person's mood, into this judgment, into this? No. Yogananda gave us an incredible system that clarifies almost every aspect, I dare to say every aspect of the spiritual life. And he made it very clear that God has 8 tangible manifestations, 8 qualities of God. That joy, that light, that sound, that peace. All these are extensions of God's grace that are radiating out from the universe into our existence, into our lives. And the more we can be open to those inner radiations of this divine presence, and learn to choose and say, yes, I will foster a receptivity to those divine qualities, a trust, and almost a preference. You know, because how often do we prefer restless states over still states? It's almost an acquired taste. But remember what Master said. The spiritual life is difficult at first, but effortlessly liberating. So if we can at least get the energy moving in that direction, spend a little longer after meditation being in the silence, opening yourself to that peace, that joy as you make your breakfast, and feel that everything you do is an extension of that inner experience of deep meditation. You start by doing it 1 minute longer, then 2, then 3, then our entire lives can be filled with that vibrancy. God chooses those who choose him. And if we learn and develop that willingness to always say yes to God in all his manifestations, we will magnetically draw those divine experiences out from our life on this plane, out from our relationships, and our faith will deepen. Thank you, dear friends. I guess we have a 10-minute break as usual, and we'll come back for meditation.